This deep dive is brought to you by CertFuel. They've got a full Series 65 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams weighted just like the real thing. Check it out at CertFuel.com.
So in late 2001, there was this massive energy company, Enron, and they filed financial statements showing, you know, billions of dollars in revenue.
Right.
Their income statement made them look like this absolute juggernaut, like a profit printing machine. Yet behind the scenes, they were bleeding cash from every single pore and were, I mean, literally days away from total collapse.
Yeah, which is insane to think about. And today we are looking at the exact financial tripwires that could have warned investors about that collapse. We are decoding financial reporting for the Series 65 exam.
Exactly.
And look, if you are looking at the exam breakdown, you might see that this topic is only about, what, 3% of the test?
Yeah, roughly 3%. Like four questions.
Right, four questions. So you might be tempted to just, you know, skim the formulas and move on to the sexier topics like options trading or portfolio management.
I get the temptation. I really do. But the problem with that strategy is that financial reporting is the absolute bedrock for every single suitability question on the entire exam.
Oh, 100%.
Like you literally cannot recommend a stock to a client if you can't read a company's financial health.
Yeah.
Recommending a security without understanding the underlying financials is basically professional malpractice.
It's like trying to recommend a diet plan to someone without bothering to check if they're like allergic to peanuts. You're going to cause a disaster.
Totally.
And if you're listening to this and dreading it because you think accounting is this dry, boring textbook topic filled with, you know, endless spreadsheets, we are going to approach this entirely differently today.
We have to. Standard lectures just don't stick.
Right. So to keep us locked in, we are going to learn every single testable concept through the chaotic, high-stakes lives of three recurring fictional characters.
Yes, I love this approach.
Yeah.
Having a concrete narrative makes the abstract rules of the Financial Accounting Standards Board actually, you know, stick in your brain.
So let's meet the cast. First up, we have Frantic Fiona.
Ah, Fiona.
Yeah, she is a landscaping entrepreneur whose business, Fiona's Fabulous Flora, is just exploding. She's building these high-end artisanal rock gardens, buying fleets of trucks, hiring crews, and she is chronically stressed about making payroll.
Highly relatable.
Very. Second, we have Devious Dan. Dan is the CEO of a massive publicly traded competitor called Global Greenery, and Dan is shady.
Oh, he's the worst.
He loves exploiting loopholes. He loves aggressive accounting tactics. His primary goal is to just inflate his stock price by literally any means necessary.
Right. Dan represents every regulatory nightmare that the SEC was essentially built to prevent.
Exactly. And finally, we have Cautious Carl. Carl is a newly minted Series 65 licensed investment advisor. He has clients relying on him, and he's trying to evaluate both Fiona's booming private business and Dan's giant public corporation just to see what is actually a suitable investment.
So he's the one trying to make sense of all the chaos.
Yeah. So I want you, the listener, to think about this for a second. If I hand you a massive stack of financial papers and I ask, hey, is this company going bankrupt tomorrow? Where do you even look first? Take a beat and think.
It's a tough question because it requires understanding not just the numbers on the page, but, you know, how those numbers were actually generated in the first place.
Right.
Before Fiona can hand her financial scorecard to Carl, Carl has to know the ground rules she used to keep score. I mean, if you don't understand the rules of the game, the final score means absolutely nothing.
So true. Let's start with the most fundamental fork in the road for any business. Cash versus accrual accounting.
The big two.
Under the cash basis, the mechanics are incredibly straightforward. You recognize revenue when the physical cash actually hits your hand.
Right.
And you recognize an expense when the cash actually leaves your hand. It's basically how you manage your personal checking account. It's how very small mom and pop shops operate.
But accrual accounting is an entirely different beast. Under the accrual basis, a company recognizes revenue when it is earned, regardless of when the cash actually changes hands.
Wait, regardless of the cash?
Yep. And it recognizes expenses when they are incurred, again, regardless of when the bill is actually paid. And here's the kicker. The SEC mandates that all publicly traded companies use accrual accounting.
Okay, so Dan has to use it. Let's put this into Fiona's world so we can actually see it work. Let's say it's the month of March. Frantic Fiona and her crew spend two grueling weeks building this massive, elaborate $4,500 patio for a wealthy client.
Sounds expensive.
Oh, yeah. The raw materials are used, the labor is done, the project is totally signed off, and it looks beautiful. But Wealthy clients being what they are, the client drags their feet and doesn't actually mail the check to Fiona until June.
Classic.
So I want you listening to answer this before we do. Under accrual accounting, what month does Fiona record that revenue? Is it March or is it June? Pause for a second.
So under accrual accounting, she records that revenue in March.
March. Because that is when the economic activity actually happened. That is when she earned it.
Exactly.
But I think we need to explore why the financial system forces companies to do this. I mean, why not just wait for the cold, hard cash? It seems simpler.
It does seem simpler, but it comes down to this foundational concept called the matching principle.
The matching principle.
Yeah. The matching principle dictates that you must match the expenses of a project to the revenue that those expenses help generate. Right in the exact same time period.
So March with March.
Right. If you separate them, you completely distort the economic reality of the business.
Think about the alternative here. If Fiona used cash accounting, her March would look like a total financial apocalypse.
Oh, a disaster.
She had to buy $2,000 worth of stone. She had to pay her workers $1,500 in wages. She spent all this cash, but zero cash came in from the client. Anyone looking at her March cash basis income statement would assume her business is in a complete death spiral.
Right. And then June rolls around. She incurs zero expenses for that patio in June, but suddenly a check for $4,500 clears the bank.
Woohoo.
Yeah. On a cash basis, June makes her look like this absolute savant printing free money with 100% profit margin.
Which is a lie.
Total lie. Cash accounting creates these wild artificial swings that hide how the business is fundamentally operating.
So accrual accounting fixes this illusion. By recognizing the revenue in March, when she actually did the work, she can match the cost of the stones and the labor against that specific revenue in March.
Exactly. Now, cautious Carl can look at her March financials and see the truth. She executed a job, it cost her money, and she generated a profit margin. The business model actually works.
But, and this is a massive but, that creates vulnerability. And this is where the Series 65 test writers are absolutely going to lay a trap for you.
Yes. Pay attention to this, guys.
This is a critical gotcha. Under accrual accounting, Fiona's income statement for March is going to show fantastic revenue and a very healthy net income.
She looks rich on paper.
She looks highly profitable on paper. But what is her actual physical bank account balance at the end of March?
It could be dangerously close to zero. I mean, she might be a highly profitable company that literally cannot afford to put gas in her landscaping trucks the next morning.
The exam will absolutely test you on this disconnect. They will present a scenario where a company is showing record profits on their accrual income statement, but is simultaneously declaring bankruptcy because they have no actual liquidity.
It's crazy, but it happens. Accrual accounting violently decouples the earning of money from the receiving of money.
We will explore how to detect that disconnect when we get to the cash flow statement. But first, we need to establish who actually writes these accrual rules. I mean, if Devious Dan is running a public company, he can't simply invent his own creative accounting methods to make his stock look better.
No, he can't. He's bound by GAAP, generally accepted accounting principles.
GAAP is the rule book. I look at GAAP kind of like the rules of Major League Baseball.
Okay, I like this.
Right. Imagine if the Yankees played by a rule where three balls is a walk. But the Red Sox played by a rule where it takes five balls to get a walk.
Chaos.
Total chaos. The statistics would be completely useless. You couldn't compare a pitcher's ERA across teams.
And cautious Carl is constantly comparing Devious Dan's company to competitors in the same sector. If they aren't all forced into the straitjacket of GAAP, Carl is comparing, you know, apples to spark plugs.
Apples to spark plugs. I love that.
GAAP ensures consistency, comparability, and transparency. And these rules are established by the FASB, the Financial Accounting Standards Board.
Okay, so FASB writes the rules. But who acts as the police? Who makes sure the auditors verifying Dan's books aren't just, like, looking the other way in exchange for a fat consulting fee?
That enforcement falls to the PCAOB, the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board. And to understand why the PCAOB even exists, you really have to look at the history of the early 2000s.
The Enron and WorldCom era.
Yeah, exactly. At that time, accounting firms were auditing massive corporations, while simultaneously pulling in millions of dollars acting as consultants for those exact same corporations.
Which is a staggering conflict of interest.
Unbelievable conflict. The auditors had every incentive to ignore fraud to keep their consulting contracts intact. So when the House of Cards collapsed, Congress stepped in and passed the Sarbanes-Oxley Act of 2002.
Commonly known as SOX.
Right, SOX.
Yeah.
And SOX created the PCAOB to audit the auditors, to strip away those conflicts of interest, and to hold corporate executives personally criminally liable for their financial statements.
No, Mar, I didn't know what my accountants were doing. Excuses for devious Dan.
Nope. He signs it if he owns it.
So we are operating in an accrual world governed by GAAP, regulated by FASB, and policed by the PCAOB.
Lots of acronyms, but yes.
Fiona is getting ready to take her company public, and Carl tells her she needs to produce her official financial scorecards. And the fundamental trick here is that these scorecards do not measure the same dimension of time.
Distinguishing how these statements handle time is a frequent stumbling block for test takers. You must separate the snapshot from the video.
Let's do a pattern interrupt right here. Stop walking, or stop staring at the wall for a second. Drill this into your brain. If a test question asks you what a company looks like on December 31st at exactly 11:59 p.m., it is asking about the balance sheet.
Yes. A balance sheet is a photograph taken in a fraction of a second. It completely freezes time. It shows you precisely what the company owns and what it owes at that exact millisecond.
Snapshot equals balance sheet. But a business is not static. A photograph of a race car doesn't tell you if it's going 200 miles an hour or if it's just parked in the garage.
Right. To see the motion of a business, you need a video.
And the videos are the income statement and the statement of cash flows. These cover a period of time, like a quarter, a full year, maybe a trailing 12 months. They show the accumulation of activity.
So let's break down the first video, the income statement, frequently referred to as the P&L or profit and loss statement.
Okay, the income statement measures profitability over that period. It's a story that starts with total sales and ends with what is actually left over for the owners.
And the specific order of operations, like what gets subtracted when, is highly testable on the 65.
So let's walk through Fiona's income statement for the year. The very first line, the absolute top of the page, is the top line. Revenue, sales. Every single dollar she billed to clients for those artisanal rock gardens.
But revenue is just a vanity metric if your costs are totally out of control.
Yeah.
I mean, you can have $1 million in sales, but if it costs you $2 million to get it, you're broke.
Right. So the first major deduction is COGS, cost of goods sold.
COGS represents the direct, unavoidable costs of creating the specific product you sold. For Fiona, this is the heady landscaping rocks, the imported soil, the specific plants, and the direct hourly labor of the crew planting that garden.
Okay, so revenue minus COGS gives you your gross profit.
Gross profit isolates the pure economics of the product itself. If Fiona's gross profit is negative, her basic business model is completely broken.
She is basically selling $20 bills for $15.
Exactly. It's unsustainable.
But assuming her gross profit is healthy, she still has to run the corporate side of the business. I mean, she has to pay rent for her headquarters. She pays the salaries of her HR department and her accountants. She pays for marketing flyers.
Right. And these are operating expenses, generally categorized on the exam as SG&A.
Selling, general, and administrative expenses.
Yep. So when you take the gross profit and subtract those operating expenses, you arrive at a really critical metric, operating income.
Also known as operating profit.
Yes. This number tells Cautious Carl how much money Fiona's core landscaping business actually generates from its daily operations.
And this is where the exam sets a massive, explicit trap. I want you, listener, to pay close attention to this distinction. Operating income is not the same thing as EBT or earnings before tax.
They are not interchangeable.
At all. Now, the test writers love to conflate these two terms. They will provide a list of financial figures and ask you to calculate EBT, hoping you will just stop at operating income.
Don't fall for it. The reason they are different is that operating income only reflects the day-to-day business of landscaping. But Fiona has financial activities that have absolutely nothing to do with planting trees.
For example, to buy her massive fleet of trucks, she took out a commercial loan. She has to pay interest on that loan every single month.
And interest expense is a non-operating item.
Right, because it's a byproduct of how she chose to finance the company, not a byproduct of her landscaping operations.
Conversely, maybe Fiona had $200,000 of excess cash sitting around last year, and she parked it in corporate bonds, so she's receiving interest income.
Or perhaps she sold an old piece of commercial real estate for a massive one-time gain. These are all non-operating items.
Exactly. So to bridge the gap from operating income down to EBT earnings before tax, you must account for all of those non-operating items.
So you subtract the interest expense, add the interest income, add any unusual investment gains.
Yep. And once you clear out all that financial noise, you finally arrive at EBT.
And here is a secondary trap right on the heels of the first one. Sometimes the exam calls it EBT, earnings before tax. Sometimes they call it pre-tax income.
That alternate terminology catches a lot of people off guard.
So let me challenge you with a scenario right now. Listener, think about this. If a trick question on the Series 65 gives you the pre-tax income figure, let's say it's $1 million, and the question asks you to calculate the EBT, what calculation do you perform? Think about it for a second.
It's a great trick. You perform zero calculations.
None. Zero. Pre-tax income and EBT are two different names for the exact same number.
They both represent the company's earnings after every single operational and non-operational expense has been paid, just before the government steps in and takes its cut.
Do not let the phrasing trick you into doing phantom math. I've seen so many people try to subtract things twice because they panic.
Oh yeah, happens all the time. Finally, from that pre-tax income, you subtract the income taxes and you arrive at the bottom line, net income.
The bottom line. This is the residual profit that ultimately belongs to the shareholders.
But before we close the book on the income statement, we have to talk about a metric that Devious Dan absolutely loves to heavily feature in his press releases.
Oh, Dan loves this one. EBITDA.
Earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization.
It is quite the mouthful. So why does Dan love it, and why does Cautious Carl actually find it useful, even though it isn't, you know, officially recognized by GAAP?
Well, to understand EBITDA, you really have to look at how companies can obscure their operational strength. Let's say Carl wants to compare Fiona's company to Dan's company.
Okay.
Fiona funded her business with cash from wealthy family members, so she has zero debt. Dan, on the other hand, funded his aggressive expansion with massive bank loans, so he has huge interest expenses.
Plus, maybe Fiona operates in a state with zero corporate income tax, while Dan operates in a high-tax state like California or New York.
Exactly. So if Carl just compares their pure net income, Dan is going to look terrible because he is getting crushed by interest and taxes.
But that doesn't necessarily mean Dan's underlying business is worse.
Right. EBITDA strips away the effects of a company's capital structure, the debt, and its tax jurisdiction. It also removes the accounting noise of depreciation.
It basically attempts to isolate the pure, raw, cash-generating horsepower of the core operations.
It levels the playing field so Carl can compare the fundamental engines of two very different companies without all the baggage.
Now, we've seen a lot of tech startups and heavily indebted companies abuse EBITDA, right? Sometimes creating absurd metrics like community-adjusted EBITDA to hide their massive losses.
Looking at you, WeWork.
Right. But for a trained analyst like Carl, standard EBITDA is still a vital tool for comparison.
Okay, so Fiona's income statement shows she is generating solid profit. But when she slides the paperwork across the table, Carl isn't completely satisfied.
He's cautious, Carl, for a reason. He tells her, look, it's great that you made a profit over the last 12 months. But if the economy crashes tomorrow morning, I need to know what you actually own and what you owe right this exact second. Can you survive a shock to the system?
Carl is asking for the snapshot.
He is asking for the balance sheet.
And the entire balance sheet is built upon one unyielding mathematical law. Assets equal liabilities plus owner's equity.
Assets equal liabilities plus equity. The fundamental accounting equation. Every single number on a balance sheet serves to support that equilibrium.
Let's break those down. Assets are resources the company owns that provide future economic benefit. Cash in the bank, inventory sitting in the warehouse, the fleet of landscaping trucks, the patents on their proprietary soil mixtures.
And liabilities are the claims against those assets by outsiders. The bank loans, the unpaid invoices from suppliers, the accrued taxes owed to the IRS.
And owner's equity, which is frequently referred to as net worth or shareholder's equity, represents the residual claim of the owners.
Let me reframe this equation so it becomes really intuitive. Imagine Cautious Carl forces Fiona to liquidate her entire company today.
A total fire sale.
Yeah, he says, Fiona, sell every single truck at auction, liquidate all the inventory, empty the checking accounts, take all of that cash, walk across the street and pay off every single bank loan, pay off every vendor, and settle up with the IRS.
Okay, so she clears all her debts.
Right. If she does that, there is going to be a pile of cash left sitting on the table. Whose cash is that?
That remaining pile is shareholders' equity. It is what the owners actually own free and clear after all outside claims are completely satisfied.
Mathematically, if you just rearrange the equation, assets minus liabilities equals equity.
Now, here's a conceptual trap regarding equity that trips people up. Let's say Devious Dan's public company reports a shareholder's equity of $50 million on its balance sheet.
Okay, 50 mil.
Does that mean if I look up his stock ticker on the open market, the company is valued at $50 million?
Absolutely not. And you need to know this. The shareholders' equity on a balance sheet represents the book value. And book value is an accounting construct heavily reliant on historical costs.
The exam will try to blur the line between book value and market value.
Market value is market capitalization. Market cap is decided every single second by thousands of irrational traders buying and selling the stock on an exchange.
Exactly. The stock market might value Dan's company at $500 million because they believe his aggressive expansion is going to just dominate the industry in 5 years.
But the balance sheet looks backward, not forward. It might only show $50 million in book value based on what he paid for his assets 10 years ago. They are two entirely different universes.
So true. Now, while analyzing Fiona's balance sheet, Carl is going to perform a very specific calculation to test her immediate survivability. He's going to evaluate her working capital.
Working capital requires us to slice those assets and liabilities into narrower time frames.
We divide them into current and non-current.
Current just means within 1 year.
Right. Current assets are highly liquid resources that the company expects to convert into cash within the next 12 months, like accounts receivable from clients or short-term investments.
And current liabilities are obligations the company absolutely must pay within the next 12 months, like the upcoming portions of a bank loan or accounts payable to suppliers.
So working capital is a simple formula: current assets minus current liabilities.
Why is this specific metric life or death for Fiona? I mean, why does Carl care so much?
Because it measures short-term liquidity. Imagine Fiona has current liabilities of $2 million. She absolutely must pay out $2 million in cash this year.
Right.
But her current assets are only $500,000. She is staring down the barrel of a massive liquidity crisis.
But wait, what if she owns a commercial warehouse worth $10 million that's fully paid off? Doesn't that mean she's rich?
It means she has a lot of non-current assets. But that warehouse is highly illiquid. You cannot pay the electric bill or meet weekly payroll with a fraction of a warehouse.
Hey guys, here's a brick for your paycheck this week.
Exactly. If her working capital is deeply negative, she will be forced into bankruptcy or forced to sell that warehouse at a massive fire sale discount just to survive. Working capital dictates who survives a recession.
So let's delve into the actual mechanics of how this statement is constructed. It is called a balance sheet because it must perpetually remain in balance. Assets must always equal liabilities plus equity. This introduces the concept of double entry accounting.
Double entry accounting. This was formalized in the 15th century by Luca Pacioli, a mathematician who actually collaborated with Leonardo da Vinci.
Fun facts.
Yeah. And it was designed as an anti-fraud measure. Every single financial transaction a company executes must affect at least two ledger entries. Every action must have an equal and opposite reaction to maintain the equilibrium.
Let's run a tangible scenario. Fiona drives to a specialty nursery and buys a rare $5,000 imported Japanese bonsai tree for a high-end client. She pays the nursery $5,000 in physical cash. How does this hit two entries and keep the balance sheet balanced?
Okay, so her cash account, which is an asset, decreases by $5,000.
Makes sense.
Simultaneously, her inventory account, which is also an asset, increases by $5,000.
Ah, so it is a simple asset for asset swap.
Exactly. Both entries occurred on the left side of the equation, plus 5,000 minus 5,000. The net change to total assets is zero. The equation remains perfectly balanced.
Okay, let's say she doesn't use cash. She goes to her local bank and takes out a $50,000 commercial loan to buy a huge new industrial wood chipper.
In that scenario, her cash account and asset increases by $50,000.
Hmm.
But to maintain balance, her debt liability on the right side of the equation also increases by $50,000.
So both sides of the scale went up by the exact same weight. Equilibrium is maintained.
Yep.
I understand the physical transactions, that's easy. But I want to push back on something that genuinely confuses people. I want to talk about the internal entry. Gotcha. Specifically, depreciation.
This is where the mechanics get highly conceptual.
Right. Fiona bought that $50,000 wood chipper. Over time, the blades dull, the engine wears out, the asset loses value, it depreciates.
Right.
But depreciation is just math on a spreadsheet. When Fiona records $5,000 of depreciation for the year, she isn't writing a check to the bank. She isn't paying a vendor. There is no external party involved at all. So how can a purely internal spreadsheet calculation possibly hit two ledger entries and alter the fundamental balance of the company?
It is a brilliant question. And the key is understanding that double entry accounting connects the different financial statements together in a closed loop system.
Walk me through the mechanics of that phantom expense.
Okay, on the left side of the balance sheet, the recorded book value of the wood chipper, which is an asset, drops by $5,000 due to depreciation.
Okay, so total assets have now decreased. To keep the equation balanced, the right side of the balance sheet must also decrease by $5,000.
Right, but her liabilities didn't change. She still owes the bank the exact same amount of money.
Correct, her liabilities are untouched, so the decrease must hit shareholders' equity. But how?
Here is the invisible bridge. That $5,000 depreciation is recorded as an operating expense on the income statement.
Oh.
That expense artificially lowers her net income for the year. And where does net income ultimately go when the year closes? It flows directly onto the balance sheet into a specific equity account called retained earnings.
Wow, okay.
Because the depreciation expense lowered her net income, her retained earnings, and therefore her total shareholders' equity is lower by exactly $5,000.
That is fascinating. Asset value drops on the left, equity drops on the right via a reduced net income. The balance is preserved.
Exactly. And Devious Dan loves to manipulate this. He might use aggressive depreciation schedules, like MCRS, which accelerates depreciation into the early years, to massively lower his net income for tax purposes, saving him millions in cash.
Sneaky.
Very. But Carl has to know how to adjust for those accounting tricks to see the real value of the assets.
Which provides the perfect transition, actually, because we need to return to the accrual illusion we mentioned way earlier.
The disconnect.
Right. Cautious Carl is looking at Fiona's P&L. Her income statement says she generated $1 million in net income. Her balance sheet says her assets equal her liabilities plus equity. Everything looks perfectly compliant with GAAP.
But Fiona is having a total panic attack because she literally cannot make payroll on Friday.
Carl is looking at the numbers and scratching his head. He needs the ultimate lie detector for accrual accounting.
He needs the statement of cash flows.
Yes. The statement of cash flows strips away all the matching principles, the depreciation magic, and the accrual timing differences. It asks one brutal, simple question. Show me the actual physical cash that entered and exited this company's bank accounts.
No more phantom math. And it organizes that cash movement into three distinct buckets: operating, investing, and financing.
Let's define the buckets real quick. Operating activities cover the core day-to-day business cycle. Cash received from clients, cash paid for inventory, cash paid to employees.
Simple enough.
Investing activities cover the purchase and sale of long-term assets. If Fiona buys a new warehouse, that is an investing cash outflow. If she sells an old truck, that is an investing cash inflow.
And financing activities detail how the company raises capital and returns capital to its backers. So, issuing new shares of stock, taking out a massive bond issuance, or paying down the principal balance on a bank loan.
Those definitions seem super intuitive, but here is the dragon you absolutely have to slay on the Series 65.
Oh, this is the big one.
This is arguably the highest yield trap regarding financial reporting. We are going to hammer this home. We must discuss how U.S. GAAP classifies interest versus dividends on the cash flow statement.
The rules established by the FASB here are highly counterintuitive, and the test writers know it. They will test you on this.
We are going to give you a definitive rule to solve this every single time on the exam, so listen closely. Here's the rule. If the item appears as the line item on the income statement, its cash flow classification is strictly operating.
Say it again.
If it lives on the income statement, it is an operating cash flow.
Let's apply that logic. First, interest paid. Fiona is paying interest on her wood chipper loan. Paying interest feels like a financing activity, right? Because it's attached to debt.
It totally feels like financing.
But where does interest expense actually live?
We established earlier that interest expense is a non-operating line item on the income statement. Therefore, following our strict rule under U.S. GAAP, paying interest is classified as an operating cash flow.
Exactly. Now, what about interest received? Say, Fiona's corporate bonds pay her interest.
That is interest income. It is on the income statement. So following the rule, it is an operating cash flow.
Okay, what about dividends received? Let's say Fiona's company owns shares of Microsoft and she receives a quarterly dividend check.
That is investment income. It is recorded on the income statement. Therefore, receiving a dividend is an operating cash flow.
Now for the fatal trap. What about dividends paid? Fiona decides her business is doing so well that she wants to distribute some of her profits, and she pays a massive cash dividend to her early investors.
Does a dividend paid ever appear as an expense on the income statement?
Nope.
No. A dividend is a distribution of profit after the net income has already been calculated. It bypasses the income statement entirely and comes directly out of retained earnings on the balance sheet
Right.
because it never touches the income statement. Paying a dividend is a financing cash flow.
Boom. The historical debate at the FASB over this was intense, by the way. Some argued interest paid should be financing. In fact, International Financial Reporting Standards, or IFRS, allows companies more flexibility to classify these differently.
But the Series 65 tests US GAAP. And under US GAAP, the lines are rigidly drawn.
Rigidly.
Let me test your recall right now, listener. I want you to answer this out loud. Fiona pays a cash dividend to her early investors. Which cash flow bucket? Take a second.
Did you say financing? Because it's financing.
Right, because it is not an income statement expense. Okay, next scenario. Fiona receives a dividend from her Microsoft stock. Which bucket?
Operating.
Because it is income on the income statement. Final scenario. Fiona pays interest on her commercial loan. Which bucket?
Operating.
Yes. Do not let the exam trick you into calling interest paid a financing activity, and do not let them trick you into calling dividends paid an operating activity. They are diametric opposites.
So now that we know the buckets, how do companies actually calculate that critical operating cash flow number?
Yeah. Do they just look at the bank statements?
It is super rare for a massive corporation to use the direct method, which essentially involves adding up every single cash register receipt. Most use the indirect method.
The indirect method is basically a reconciliation process. Instead of building from the ground up, it starts at the end and works backward.
Right. It starts with the net income figure from the income statement. But as we established, net income is full of accrual accounting illusions and phantom expenses. So we have to scrub it clean.
We adjust it by adding back non-cash expenses and factoring in changes to working capital accounts.
And the most prominent add back is depreciation.
Walk us through the specific math of why we add back depreciation to net income to find our true cash flow.
Sure, let's use a simplified example. Fiona's income statement shows she earned $10,000 in revenue. She had zero cash expenses, but she recorded $2,000 in depreciation for her trucks.
Okay.
So her net income is therefore $8,000.
But the $2,000 in depreciation didn't actually leave her bank account.
Precisely. If we want to know how much cash she actually generated, we start with a net income of $8,000. We recognize the $2,000 deduction was a phantom accounting entry, so we add it back.
8,000 plus 2,000 equals $10,000 of operating cash flow.
Exactly. We are reversing the non-cash penalty to reveal the true cash generation.
You also have to adjust for working capital. If her accounts receivable went up by $50,000, meaning her clients owe her 50 grand more than they did last year, she hasn't collected that cash. It is tied up.
So you must subtract that $50,000 from net income.
But if her accounts payable went up, meaning she delayed paying her suppliers, she actually conserved cash, so you add that back.
The statement of cash flows is the great equalizer. When Carl compares Dan and Fiona, he might see Dan has a massive net income but negative operating cash flow because all his revenue is tied up in uncollected receivables. The cash flow statement reveals the structural integrity of the business.
It is the ultimate lie detector. But, and this is a big but, that assumes the numbers on the paper are actually real. Which brings us to the next massive problem for Carl.
Verification.
Exactly. Cautious Carl is scrutinizing devious Dan's public filings for Global Greenery. Dan's income statement claims his company made $1 billion. His balance sheet looks pristine. His cash flows are positive.
But Carl knows Dan is a shark.
Right. How do we know Dan isn't just fabricating these numbers out of thin air?
We need an independent auditor to verify the records. But the exam will test your understanding that not all financial examinations are created equal.
The level of assurance varies wildly depending on what the accountant is actually hired to do.
Let's do a direct comparison of the levels of examination. A company can engage an accountant for three distinct services: compilation, a review, or a full audit.
Let's start at the very bottom, a compilation.
A compilation provides zero assurance to an investor like Carl.
Wait, zero assurance? Why would a company even pay for that?
You are essentially paying for formatting services. The accountant takes management's internal numbers, puts them into a standard GAAP compliant spreadsheet, and hands them back.
So they don't check anything.
Nothing. The accountant does not perform any investigative procedures. They do not check bank statements. They do not verify inventory. They simply compile the data provided.
So if Dan hands the accountant a cocktail napkin with $1 billion written on it, the accountant formats it and stamps compilation.
Pretty much. It is practically useless for deep due diligence.
What about a review?
A review is a moderate step up. It provides limited assurance. In a review, the accountant will perform analytical procedures, like comparing this year's margins to last year's, and they will interview management.
So if something looks wildly out of place, they will ask questions.
Yes, but they are not performing deep invasive testing.
Which brings us to the gold standard. The level of examination legally required by the SEC for all public companies. A full audit performed by an independent CPA firm.
A full audit provides reasonable assurance that the financial statements are free of material misstatement. Notice it doesn't say absolute guarantee. I mean, fraud can still be hidden, but the auditors dig deep.
They test the company's internal software controls. They send letters directly to the company's banks to confirm cash balances. They physically walk into the warehouses and count the inventory.
And most importantly, at the end of this grueling process, the lead auditor issues a formal, signed auditor's opinion.
And this is where you need to recalibrate your vocabulary. The terminology used in auditor opinions is an explicit exam trap because the words mean the exact opposite of how they are used in everyday conversational English.
This is so tricky.
In normal life, if someone is described as unqualified, it means they are incompetent. You wouldn't hire an unqualified pilot, right?
Right. That would be bad.
But in the inverted world of auditing, an unqualified opinion is the absolute best possible outcome.
An unqualified opinion means the auditor is issuing their approval without any qualifications, without any reservations, asterisks, or caveats. They are formally stating that the financial statements are presented fairly in all material respects in accordance with GAAP.
It's a clean bill of health. Unqualified is the holy grail for a public company. But what happens if the auditor finds a discrepancy? Like, what if Dan accounted for his European subsidiary using a completely bizarre non-JAP method?
Then the auditor issues a qualified opinion.
Again, backwards language. Usually, being highly qualified is a huge compliment.
Here, a qualified opinion means the financials are fairly presented, except for a specific identified issue.
The auditor is qualifying their sign-off. Everything looks good, except for this one specific geographic division.
The critical distinction for the exam is that a qualified opinion implies the misstatement is material. It is large enough that an investor should know about it, but it is not pervasive.
So it does not poison the entire financial statement. It is an isolated tumor that the auditor is pointing out.
Exactly.
So unqualified is perfect. Qualified is a yellow caution flag. What is the ultimate red flag?
That is an adverse opinion.
Oof, adverse.
An adverse opinion is a catastrophic event for a public company. It means the financial statements do not present fairly. The auditor has concluded that the misstatements are both material and depervasive. The numbers are fundamentally corrupted and totally unreliable.
If a company receives an adverse opinion, the SEC will immediately halt trading, the stock will crater, and the executives will likely be facing subpoenas. It means the company is lying, and the lies are everywhere.
Finally, there's a fourth category. A disclaimer of opinion.
This sounds like a legal technicality.
It is essentially the auditor throwing their hands in the air and just walking away. A disclaimer means the auditor was entirely unable to gather enough evidence to even form an opinion.
Why would that happen?
Well, perhaps a massive fire destroyed the server farm housing the financial records. Or more nefariously, perhaps Devious Dan simply refused to give the auditors access to the offshore bank accounts.
So the auditor issues a disclaimer stating, we cannot tell you if these numbers are accurate because management literally prevented us from looking.
Exactly.
So let me ask you directly, listener. If Cautious Carl is building a retirement portfolio for a conservative client and he is reading Global Greenery's annual report, which of those four auditor opinions is the absolute minimum standard he should accept before recommending the stock? Take a beat.
He must demand an unqualified opinion.
Unqualified, the clean bill of health. If a company cannot produce unqualified financials, Carl cannot establish suitability.
And that introduces our final major topic. We know Dan needs an unqualified audit, but how does that information actually reach Carl and the rest of the investing public?
Right. Dan cannot just keep his audited financials locked in a desk drawer. The SEC forces him to spill the financial tea on a rigid, highly regulated schedule.
We need to decode the alphabet soup of SEC filings. The three primary forms you must know are the 10K, the 10Q, and the 8K.
Let's start with the cornerstone of corporate disclosure, the Form 10K.
The 10K is the comprehensive annual report filed with the SEC. is an incredibly dense, exhaustive document.
It contains a deep dive into the business model, the legal proceedings, the management's discussion and analysis known as MD&A, and most critically for the exam, it must contain the fully audited financial statements.
Depending on the market capitalization of the company, the 10K must be filed within 60 to 90 days after the end of their fiscal year.
But here is a highly specific exam trap. You might see a question asking you to distinguish between the Form 10K and the annual report to shareholders. Are they the exact same document?
No, they are absolutely not the same document.
The 10K is a stark, legally binding black and white SEC form. It reads like a dense legal contract.
The annual report to shareholders, on the other hand, is that glossy, magazine-style brochure the company mails out. It features high-resolution photos of the CEO looking visionary, colorful charts, and these super optimistic letters.
While it contains the same financial data, it is heavily massaged by the marketing department. The 10K is the unvarnished, legally actionable truth.
The 10K provides the annual baseline, but the stock market moves too fast to wait 12 months for an update. Investors need real-time data. That is why the SEC mandates the Form 10-Q.
Q stands for quarterly. The 10-Q is filed after the first, second, and third quarters of the fiscal year.
Because the market needs this information quickly, the filing deadline is shorter, usually 40 to 45 days.
And this leads to the most critical distinction between the two forms. What is the auditing requirement for a 10-Q?
The financial statements within a 10-Q are unaudited.
Wait, why would the SEC allow unaudited numbers?
Pragmatism. I mean, a full, unqualified audit takes massive amounts of manpower and months to complete. It is physically and financially impossible for a global corporation to undergo a full audit every 90 days.
That makes sense.
So the SEC requires that the quarterly financials be reviewed by the auditors, providing that limited assurance we discussed, but they do not require a full audit until the annual 10K.
10K is annual and audited. 10Q is quarterly and unaudited. Lock that into your memory.
But what happens when the narrative goes completely off the rails? Let's run a catastrophic scenario.
Oh, I love these.
It's a random Tuesday in October. Devious Dan's aggressive accounting tactics are finally exposed by an internal whistleblower. The board of directors discovers he has been funneling corporate cash to fund a private yacht.
Of course he has a yacht.
They convene an emergency meeting and fire him for cause at 2 in the afternoon. Does the company wait until the next quarter's 10-Q to casually mention that the CEO was terminated for embezzlement?
The SEC would bring down the hammer if they tried that. The market has an absolute right to know about material events immediately.
Right.
So, direct question for you listening. Which SEC form does the company file to announce this sudden, massive change, and exactly how many days do they have to file it? Think about it.
They are required to file a Form 8K.
8K, and the strict time frame.
They must file it within 4 business days of the triggering event.
4 business days. The 8K is the current report. It acts as the emergency broadcast system for corporate America.
It is used for major unscheduled material events. If the company acquires a rival, if they declare bankruptcy, if a board member abruptly resigns, or if their auditor suddenly quits because they suspected fraud, all of that triggers an 8K within 4 business days.
There is one final document we should touch upon, which Carl uses to evaluate corporate governance.
Right.
The DEF 14A.
Commonly known as the proxy statement.
The proxy statement is essentially the ballot packet sent to shareholders before the annual meeting. It tells the owners what they are actually voting on.
It lists the nominees for the board of directors. And critically, it details executive compensation.
If Carl wants to discover exactly how many millions of dollars Devious Dan was paying himself in stock options while the company was bleeding cash, he doesn't look in the 10K. He looks in the DE14A proxy statement.
It is the ultimate tool for transparency regarding how the executives are enriching themselves and how the board is structured.
We have covered massive ground today. We established the accrual ground rules, dismantled the 3 financial scorecards, navigated the cash flow lie detector, translated the backwards language of auditor opinions, and decoded the SEC filing deadlines.
It is a lot, but it's time for a rapid-fire recap to cement this into your short-term memory.
Let's lock in the highest yield testable takeaways. I want you to try to answer these prompts out loud before the expert provides the answer. We are going to move fast. Here we go. The auditor opinion that signifies a perfectly clean bill of health.
Unqualified opinion.
The auditor opinion that signifies material and pervasive corruption.
Adverse opinion.
Cash flow classification for dividends paid to shareholders.
Finance and cash flow.
Cash flow classification for dividends received from an investment.
Operating cash flow.
Cash flow classification for interest paid on a bank loan.
operating cash flow, because it lives on the income statement.
The two terms that represent the exact same pre-tax profit number on the income statement.
Pre-tax income and EBT.
The SEC form that contains fully audited financial statements.
The Form 10-K.
The SEC form that contains unaudited financial statements.
The Form 10-Q.
The SEC form triggered when a company declares bankruptcy on a random Thursday.
Form 8-K, which must be filed within 4 business days.
And finally, snapshot versus video. Which financial statement represents a static snapshot at a single point in time?
The balance sheet.
If you can recall those distinctions under pressure, you're going to navigate the financial reporting questions on the Series 65 with absolute confidence.
You really will. But I want to leave you with one final thought before we wrap up. You can memorize these rules to pass a regulatory exam. You can drill flashcards until you reflexively know that dividends paid is a financing activity.
But remember the human element behind these mechanics. Remember why Cautious Carl actually utilizes them.
Exactly. Behind every dense 10K, behind every complex working capital adjustment, is someone's life savings, a real person's retirement future.
It is the bedrock of suitability.
When you learn how to read these vital signs, when you can look at a company that is reporting massive net income but negative operating cash flow, and you recognize that discrepancy as a fatal flaw, you aren't just answering a multiple choice question correctly. You might be saving a client from investing their nest egg in the next Enron. The numbers always tell a story. Your fundamental job as an advisor is to look beyond the top line marketing and read the unvarnished truth of that story.
The glossy annual report might look pristine, but you have to know how to inspect the foundation. You are now one step closer to crushing the Series 65. Keep analyzing, keep questioning the numbers, and we will catch you on the next deep dive.